You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of August 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
Look, the president is sending a strong message to North Korea in the kind of language that North Korea understands.
It turns out that Donald Trump wasn't really threatening to drown Southeast Asia in a lake of atomic fire, merely making himself clear. Absolutely nothing to worry about. My guests Mari Bion and Brian Klass will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Emmanuel Macron's faltering attempt to get his fellow French politicians to swallow the do-as-I-say, not-do-as-I-do line, the thinning ice, closing net, circling vultures and every other cliché of political doom impending upon Benjamin Netanyahu, and the global war on tourism. And yes, I pronounced that right. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Mari Bion, a UK correspondent for French media, and Brian Klass, fellow in comparative politics at the London School of Economics. Welcome both. We will start tonight with the confrontation between North Korea and the United States. In the last 24 hours, this has been increasingly personalised as a macho showdown between a belligerent, impulsive, weird-haired demagogue with little understanding of the outside world and the chairman of the Workers' Party of Korea. Interestingly, in the hours after Donald Trump ratcheted up the threat to implicit warning of nuclear obliteration, other US officials attempted to ratchet it back down again. Brian, possibly willfully stupid question at this point, is this a deliberate, clever, cunning and calculated good cop, bad cop strategy, or is this just a total shambles?
No, I think the term that best applies is adhocracy to this, where they're just doing this, you know, just making it up as they go along. Trump was winging it. You know, there was this hope that he was reading from a script, and we found out later that actually the paper he was looking at was a fact sheet on the opioid epidemic. He made up the words himself as he went. And the truly astonishing thing is that although his national security team was aware that he would likely be asked about North Korea, the terminology he used, which basically reflected words that Harry Truman had said the day that that Hiroshima was bombed.
Do we think Trump knew that?
Probably not, but it may have come out in a piece because, you know, it was 2 days after the anniversary. He may have read a piece about Hiroshima and seen that rhetoric. But the really astonishing thing here is that the U.S. government is telling the world to ignore the words of the president. Their job is the cleanup crew. So all the people who know what they're doing in government, they come in after Trump has said something extremely reckless, and they say, never mind. And that's going to have ripple effects much beyond Trump's presidency if we start to believe that what the words of the president, the words coming out of the president's mouth, do not matter anymore.
Mari Bion, it is an interesting point, and it is something we haven't had to deal with before necessarily, in that obviously all leaders, when they say things, it's not always necessarily 100% the truth, but at least it's some suggestion of what they're thinking. It's something, you know, there's a message they're trying to send. How much more complicated does it make the world if nobody's sure if the President of the United States is serious or not?
Well, I guess that makes it very, very complicated, because as he likes to say himself, I think he's the most powerful man in the world. So if the most powerful man in the world says something he doesn't mean, first thing, it's very confusing for people and for people who are the aim of the comment, like here the leader of North Korea. They might just want to take it as an aggression, although he doesn't mean it as an aggression, just as bumping up his muscles. So that can be confusing for people, dangerous for people who have power, who think that it's not just show off but it's real, or just decide, even though they know. I mean, I guess they both know, the two men know, that they want to show off their power, but any one of them can just decide, well, I don't believe it's for show, I believe it's for real, and I'm gonna strike first. So that's what the team of Donald Trump wanted to play down, but it's still, I guess, a possibility of people can really much think, if we can't believe the President of the United States, someone else might well believe him, and that can be a real escalation.
Brian, it's a, probably a wider and more complicated question as to whether North Korea has fully got its head around this or not. But 6 months into this fiasco, with the assumption that there's at least another 3.5 years of it to go, are we seeing countries around the world, again, I said possibly excluding North Korea, beginning to understand, okay, we cannot take this man seriously. We're just going to have to figure out a way to work either around him or around the United States.
Well, I think they might be trying to do that, but, you know, at the end of the day, the words coming out of his mouth matter because he's the president of the United States. It was like when the tweets...
Except that we've already seen him, you know, recently, his sort of like bizarre sort of brainwave about transgender soldiers, and you almost immediately saw actual military officials just going, we're probably not going to do that.
That's true, but at the end of the day, with stuff with nuclear weapons, there is one person that is in control of them, and that's Donald Trump. There's no check on him. If he said that the whole system is designed for rapid response, because the idea was that, you know, if the Soviet Union attacked the United States, the president had to be able to respond in a matter of minutes with no check. So while his advisors can reason with him, there is nobody that could actually stop him. So if he says we're going to rain fire and fury on North Korea if they make a threat, I mean, it is really worrying that 3 hours later, North Korea made a threat. They made a specific threat. And so I think the bigger picture here is not just the fact that the world is ignoring Trump's words, but it's also that the deterrence capabilities of the United States were just undercut in the same way that Obama's red line in Syria was, where he said, any more threats will be met with fire and fury. The threat came, nothing happened. So now North Korea doesn't need to take Donald Trump's words seriously. The next red line, what if it's real? And North Korea won't know that. And that's why this war is unlikely to occur out of rational basis, because it is not in the interest of either side to have a war. But most wars start out of miscalculation. This is what happened in the Gulf War when Iraq invaded Kuwait, and they thought the U.S. wouldn't intervene. It was the catastrophic miscalculation for Saddam Hussein, but it can happen based on the words of the United States government. And that's why I think I'm really worried that Trump's recklessness could lead us down a very dangerous path indeed.
Well, Austria-Hungary thought they could beat up Serbia in about 3 weeks as well, and discovered otherwise. Murray, you mentioned that there is the danger of ratcheting it up tensions. It can get beyond everybody's control. And the usual wisdom is that you should only make threats if you're absolutely certain in your own mind that you will back them up if your bluff is called. And Brian mentioned the example of Barack Obama laying down red lines in Syria, which he declined to police. But does the presence of Donald Trump, or the fact of Donald Trump making those threats, change that rule if everybody else understands that he'll get bored with this in 5 minutes and move on to something else?
I don't think it changes any rule, because we know that Donald Trump doesn't play by any rule, so you just have to take him as he goes. So if one day he wants to say something, we're going to rain fire and fury, and then 3 hours ago, not response to a threat of North Korea, it's not that he's not consistent. It's just that he's being Donald Trump. And that's the complexity of dealing with the president. But you have to remember that at the same time, the team was already trying to play down what the president had just said. So it's even more complicated than just it's just Donald Trump who's not ready to be called his bluff. It's just that he still has people trying to at least change the rhetoric of the coming out of the White House, because they know, and Donald Trump doesn't seem to care about that, but they know that creating a panic is the last thing that that should happen at this moment. So it was the fireman who started the fire, and the crew behind him was trying to kill the flames behind him, but at the same time, people who are not supporters of Donald Trump, because I guess supporters of Donald Trump, you might know more better than me that, but supporters of Donald Trump, I think, are very happy about him flexing his muscle, because Barack Obama never flexed his muscle against North Korea this way. So supporters may be very happy. Those who are not supporting Donald Trump may know that Donald Trump is ridiculous. May think he's a ridiculous man, but they still think that indeed he can push the button wherever he wants. That's not reassuring anyone.
Brian, is there finally anything at all to be said for the he's talking to North Korea in language North Korea understands argument? Because there certainly is an argument that years of careful, patient, you know, pipe-sucking, finger-steepling, five-dimensional diplomacy by more, I guess, traditional diplomatic minds did not stop North Korea from turning into a nuclear-armed state.
Well, First off, I think that, you know, the language that people like Secretary of Defense Mattis and Rex Tillerson used accomplished the same goal. It said, look, if you keep up with this, we will beat you if there's ever a military conflict. But it was in diplomatic language that's not prone to miscalculation. I think that's really important. I mean, I think when you have people in North Korea who are analysts trying to figure out how to translate bigly into Korean, right? I mean, this is something, it's a real problem. It's genuinely a problem because a lot of their analysts will not be people who are actually educated in the West. They will not have experience with the nuance of the English language.
It's difficult enough trying to translate a lot of Trump into English.
Exactly. And this is where I think there's a real risk of miscalculation on the Korean side. We're banking on the fact that we are not misinterpreting, but we're also banking on the fact that Kim Jong-un and his entourage are not misinterpreting any of these signals. The thing that really scares me with this story, though, and, you know, be brief, but is that there's now a likelihood that they can miniaturize a warhead. And what happens the next time that a missile launch occurs that's a test, and Donald Trump is told, we have a 90% confidence that there's no nuclear missile on this, right? We don't know anymore. In the past, we had the luxury of thinking a missile test was just a test of a missile, not a potential nuclear launch. And now we're relying on Donald Trump not overreacting if they shoot a missile towards Guam as a provocation. Then, you know, Donald Trump might think, well, if it's a 15% chance this has got a nuke on it, let's preempt it. And that's where, you know, this recklessness is really, really worrying. And I think we can say, oh, it's just bluster. But at the end of the day, he's the guy that decides. And that's scary.
Well, let's take a look now at France, where recently elected and already unpopular President Emmanuel Macron has passed a new law intended, it says here, to moralise public life. One practical upshot of this is that members of parliament will no longer be permitted to employ members of their families and will have to dismiss those they already do. However, a certain amount of umbrage has been taken at the fact that, at the same time, Macron has been attempting to solicit a formal title, staff and budget for his wife, and at least as he sees it, presumptive First Lady of the Fifth Republic. Murray, this is off the back, of course, of the scandals that engulfed Marine Le Pen and to a much greater extent François Fillon during the presidential election campaign. How serious was the outrage among French people? It's not like this was news, is it?
No, it wasn't news. It's just that it's starting to be quite unpopular because you have to remember there's 5 weeks of work behind him now. And during these 5 weeks of parliamentary work in particular, there were 6 laws that were voted. We haven't seen this much things happening in France for more than 5 years with François Hollande. So, I mean, French people are quite surprised by that. And the opposition to Macron is very vociferous and very vocal. So he's very unpopular because of that. So they built on that as well, on the fact that he was supposed to be the Jupiterian president, the best guy ever, the best president we would have, and just reality stuck in. So in a way, they made the best of that. It is true that this idea of First Lady is something that's a bit unnerving for French people, because all the wives of the presidents we have, they all had a specific behind-the-scene role. It was very, very old-fashioned. Mm-hmm. Bernadette Chirac, the wife of de Gaulle, apart from Mitterrand, who had a second non-official wife, of course. But they all, you know, were devoted to their husband. They didn't really have a career. Bernadette Chirac had a career after her husband wasn't president anymore. It was very old-fashioned, and French people might be old-fashioned in that way, that they like to have the woman behind the scene just playing the hostess. Brigitte Macron is an older woman who could have been retiring and who's retired, in fact, now, but he's devoted to her husband as well, but want to be recognized as someone who's part of building the career of her husband. And she doesn't want to go into the shadow now. She wants to still be very active, but she wants to be recognized as someone who's doing something. And I think that's quite... if she was younger, the problem would be even more complicated, because a younger woman, same age of Emmanuel Macron, would have a career herself and would be working. And normally, a first lady doesn't have to quit her job, contrary to the US. But still, she has to be at the beck and call of her husband as president of the France. So it would be a problem that would have to be solved if she was younger and had a job. The fact is that Brigitte Macron is older, doesn't have a job, so French people decide that it's too complicated and too fiery for them in a way to decide now. Next time, when as a younger lady, perhaps it would be more progressive. At the moment, it is not being seen as a progressive issue.
Brian, is it weird that Emmanuel Macron is so blind to the optics of this? On the one hand, informing his fellow politicians that they can no longer employ their family, while at literally the same time trying to get his wife a job.
Well, I think, you know, from an American perspective, what I see Macron doing is basically trying to become the American president. Mm-hmm. You know, you've seen all these photo shoots of him looking like a military commander and also trying to develop this formalized role for the First Lady. And I think, you know, after his successful reception for Trump, there is a bit of this, okay, we're both outsiders. Let's try to make this mimic the optics of what the American president as the head of state in a way that is divorced from just government, you know, policy. And that's something in the United States context that's usually very helpful to presidents, because attitudes towards the First Lady are typically much more positive and nonpartisan. So, you know, Michelle Obama was seen overwhelmingly in a positive light. And throughout Barack Obama's term, even when he was in the low approval ratings, on a personal level, people saw him positively. So there's a possibility that Macron is trying to find a way to shield himself from the political bickering and say, look, we've got a role for the First Lady that's outside politics, that has a staff and can be seen as some sort of unifying force. And that's why, you know, obviously the optics are terrible to pass this law and then try to do this, but he would probably argue that this is something that can be seen as a unifying force for the country and that for the president it's exempted. Obviously, it would be easier to pass if he was making it applicable after his term in office.
Murray, I mentioned in the introduction to this discussion that Macron was not at the moment terrifically popular. But why has he tanked so badly so quickly? He was popular enough to get elected, what, weeks ago, really? Mm-hmm. And he's now polling at 36%. What happened?
I think that it's really much the fact that he's doing a lot of things. Things that he said he would do and he was elected for, that is to say, passing laws and trying to change France. That's something he's doing, and that's something that's ruffling the feathers of French people who don't want to see their labor law changing and this kind of thing. The other thing is that what he's trying to do is very much the term is even in the phrasing of the law. It's an organic law. It's not just going to be changed, you know, on the corners. It's going to be very much at the center of the ethic and the way of life of France. Changing the labor law is something it's not just another law that you don't know about. It's something that's going to change your life. And he's passed this law recently that is going to make possible the changing the labor law without going through parliament. So the thing he's doing, which is very important, and the way he's doing it, being his Jupiterian president, trying to do things without consulting the parliament, is something that's not really much liked by the French people.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Mari Bion and Brian Klass. Coming up next, is this the beginning of the end for Benjamin Netanyahu?
Monocle's dedicated network of international bureau and correspondents bring the best global stories to our readers and listeners. Our eagle-eyed team of editors and journalists staffing bureau in Toronto, New York, Zurich, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Tokyo deliver the best content from the world's most important regions straight to the airwaves of Monocle 24 and the pages of Monocle magazine. We've also got boots on the ground in more than 30 cities worldwide thanks to our comprehensive correspondent network. It's for this reason Monocle brings an up-to-date, informed and engaging commentary from Brasilia to Brussels and from Sydney to Singapore. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Mari Bion and Brian Klass. Now, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is one of those leaders who has dominated his national politics so completely for so long that it's difficult to imagine his country led by anyone else. Israelis and the rest of us may shortly have to get used to the idea, however. Netanyahu is embroiled, if not indeed enmeshed, in corruption scandals, which have seen him questioned by police four times. Never a good look for elected office holders. Taking a somewhat familiar tone, Netanyahu has decried the whole thing as fake news. Brian, what do we know about what he's actually accused of?
Sure. So there's two major cases that involve him directly. There's some others that involve him tangentially. But the main ones, case 1000 is related to Netanyahu supposedly receiving hundreds of thousands of dollars of gifts. And the question is whether there was a quid pro quo attached to them, whether there was some sort of favor, and this was bribery. Netanyahu has basically acknowledged the gifts and has not said that he had a quid pro quo and has denied that. The second one, I think, is probably more problematic for him. And this is where there was a recording released to the law enforcement that involves him trying to cut a deal with a newspaper to have more favorable coverage of Netanyahu in exchange for a legal change that would result in a better bottom line, basically more profits for the paper. And Netanyahu was, I mean, he's caught with this. They have the recording. He basically said that he did not go through with it. And the newspaper's coverage has still been negative. I mean, there's some striking parallels. Honestly, I don't want to bring it back to the U.S. too much, but there is some striking parallels here, right? Where the email gets produced with Donald Jr. and they say, yeah, we took the meeting with the Russians, but nothing ever came of it. The intent is clearly here with Netanyahu too, where he tried to engage in bribery, and that is obviously potentially fatal to his political career. But it depends how much evidence is brought forth by this star witness that has now flipped, who had the recordings and effectively was a fly on the wall during these proceedings, whether that evidence actually amounts to something that can take him down or not.
Netanyahu has also described the media as enlisting in an obsessive and unprecedented hunt against me and my family with a goal to carry out a government coup. Again, this is rhetoric that sounds vaguely familiar, so thank you, Donald Trump, for that contribution to politics around the world. Murray, someone in his position, none of this looks good. At what point is someone in his position done for, at indictment or actual conviction?
Well, if he's indicted, he doesn't have to resign, so he can stay on. I'm not sure he would like to resign if he's condemned or anything. There's nothing. It would be a first for the young enough state of Israel. It's going to be down to political pressure. Will he be able to stand to stay as prime minister, even if he's indicted, just because of the political pressure? At the moment where violence is flaring up again in the region, having a prime minister who is very weakened by personal affairs is not something that anyone wants, of course. So it might be his undoing. But if there's no outside political pressure or public pressure, it can take month and month for him to be indicted and to possibly have to resign. But there's nothing in the law that will push him out of his job.
Brian, we've spoken once or twice about Donald Trump as a stress test for American institutions. And is it at least arguable, if we're trying to be positive here, that this is similar for Israeli institutions, which in the past have a pretty solid record on this? Prime Minister Ehud Olmert went to prison on corruption charges. President Moshe Katsav went to jail on rape charges. They do actually go after people in people who abuse power.
That's right. And also, there is overwhelming support in polls to suggest that if he is indicted, that he should resign. So the Israeli people are, you know, pretty clear on this one. And the institutions have held up in the past. But Netanyahu is a unique political force in Israel. He is so popular, and he's been so popular over the years, rather, and he's bent Israeli politics to his will to an extent that we haven't really seen. And so, you know, the question is, when this becomes a fundamentally political question, as it probably will, unless he is actually jailed, will his own party, the Likud party, turn on him? And that's the big question, I think, that we'll see coming out. But yeah, it could be a good stress test. This is a question about institutions and their resilience in the face of corruption charges that seem to be reasonably clear cut. The question, though, is, at what point does this become commonplace, if he is able to survive, where politicians believe they can just sort of bend the rules and get away with it, until the actual smoking gun? I mean, it's like in both America and Israel, it's like the expectation is that we want to have a tape of the prime minister or the president saying, I did it. And if we don't have that, it's not enough, right? I mean, but like, we genuinely have a tape that says, that he tried to do it. And so whether he did or not, it should be troubling enough that people should hold their politicians to a higher standard. And that's what I think we'll see in Israel, hopefully.
Okay, well, finally tonight, it's that time of year at which many listeners are either on holiday or packing in anticipation thereof. However, in some popular destinations, there is a dwindling likelihood of a warm welcome. This summer has seen resentment of tourists go beyond such traditional expressions as harumphing waiters and rapacious taxi drivers into full-blown anti-tourist protests. Marches filling the streets of San Sebastian and Mallorca and the bits of Venice that you can actually fill without getting wet. We've also seen Mallorca and Ibiza capping tourist beds. Murray, is this just first world problems? Is this just rich people who've never really been anywhere that tourists don't want to go whining?
Well, it looks like a rich people problem indeed, that's for sure. It's true that now with the prices of the flights, it's so easy. It's even easier for someone in London to go to Ibiza than to go to Dorset, for example.
It's certainly cheaper if you're trying to travel by train in Britain.
Well, yes, it's very expensive to travel by train in Britain. So yes, indeed. So why might not as well go to Ibiza? And of course, the weather is a bit better as well. So lots of people want to go to this kind of destination. But it's, as I understand, it's very often a last-minute decision, something that's been decided at the last minute. So many don't even try to hear to learn a little bit of the language they're going to. So they arrive with their English, thinking, "Well, I speak English. Everybody should be speaking English." And they don't even try. They say perhaps "Hola" in Spain, but that's about it. So with this new way of booking holidays, there's less respect from the tourist for the country they're going to. So that could be, apparently, that could be one of the antagonizing issues. But it is true as well that the economy of some of those cities are more and more turned to tourism because, of course, it's a money-making industry.
Indeed.
And it's sometimes to the detriment of the people living there. And it's low-paid job for young people. It's a good thing in a way, but on the other side, of course, low-paid job means lower job at the end of the line. So there's a big it's a big issue for the economy, the local economy for these towns.
Brian, is there ever an argument for capping tourists? I mean, I'm sure we have all been in places at high season at which we wish there was a cap on tourists, which means, of course, that we're wishing that there was a cap on tourists that didn't include us. That makes you the equivalent of that person sitting in their car complaining about the traffic. But there are, of course, some places where large numbers of people, Venice being plausibly one of them, do actually cause actual damage to the place that everyone's come to see.
Yeah, I mean, at the point where there's damage being done, they need to have better regulations, especially to historical sites and the like. But overall, I find this to be a big Crimea River problem. I mean, you know, some of these countries are dealing with the fallout still from, you know, the EU's various crises. And they have 30 or 40% youth unemployment, and they're complaining about tourism, which generates youth employment. I mean, it's an amazing thing when you have such slow growth to really just be willing to shoot yourself in the economic foot over complaints that people want to come to your country. You know, it's a very baffling thing. And I think, yeah, it's annoying, but come on, this is the way that you get money into the economy. It can create development. It can create all sorts of different knock-on industries as well, because then the people who make money in tourism spend it in the economy. It has knock-on effects. And I've seen this in places, you know, in Tunisia, where I lived for several months in 2013, after their spate of terrorist attacks targeting tourists, the economy tanked. You know, it's like they're looking at Spain, where all these people have now flocked to as a result of the fact that Tunisia is seen to be unsafe. And they're thinking, please come back. You know, we used to get one cruise ship a day. Now we're happy if we have one a month. And I mean, I cannot imagine what it looks like for a Tunisian who works on the docks, not able to feed their family with these protesters saying, leave us. You know, I mean, come on.
Well, on that thought, which brings us to the end of today's show, I will suggest actually to any listeners who haven't yet booked a holiday, Tunisia, hell of a nice place to visit. I've been there once, really enjoyed it. The island of Djerba, in particular, would be my tip if you're visiting Tunisia, which you should. Brian Klass and Murray Bion, thank you both very much for joining us. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Rabello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Isabel Rosen and Audrey Fyodorenko, and our studio manager was Josh Prince. Carlotta's up next with more music at 1900. Andrew Tuck is in with The Urbanist, and there's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. I'm back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.